burning down the house. We are burning down the house. Welcome. Here every Wednesday at 8 on heritageradionetwork.com. A continuing conversation about the culture of architecture and design, in which we tear down, lay forth, and build up the elements, the attitudes, opinions, obsessions, fantasies, passions, and ideas that inform and direct the creation of our built environment. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host, and this episode for December 16th is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. 155,000 acres of grassland supports grass-fed, grass-finished steers, providing you with the absolutely best beef experience. Now, you can obtain Hearst Ranch beef through their website at hearstranch.com. And I have had Hearst beef here at Roberta's Restaurant in the East Williamsburg Industrial Park, scenic Brooklyn. And it was absolutely fabulous. Now, our primary and topic of departure this evening is the Omega Center for Sustainable Living at the Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York. And we have a guest joining us by telephone. Are you there?
I am here.
Excellent. Introduce yourself.
I'm Skip Backus. I'm CEO of Omega Institute in Rhinebeck.
And for those of you here in the United States, I highly recommend it. It's a very tranquil bit of land you have there. You have the lake, and it's full of all sorts of evolved human beings who gather together at Omega to, what do they do there?
Well, I would sum it up as we're a center for wellness, personal growth. We have about 23,000 people a year that come through. We have programs that run everything from meditation and yoga to the arts and also sustainability.
We're
on 200 some odd acres just outside of Rhinebeck.
Yes. I have been there. Once upon a time, I did some work for Jerry Salenti, who you probably know, just down the road at the Trends Research Institute in Rhinebeck. And joining us in studio here to join in our conversation are an eco-friendly builder, Gennaro Brooks Church from Brooklyn. Say hello.
Hello.
And Jacob Allspector, an architect in New York, who's an expert in all sorts of different aspects of our profession and obsession. Hi, Jake.
How are you? Nice to be back.
And is Jake's mic lit? I didn't hear you when you spoke.
Hello.
Oh, that's better. Thank you. Now,
nice to be back.
So you have this new building. It's been occupied how long?
We've been open since last May.
That's a good period of time. Mm-hmm. And now, it's an interesting program because it conforms to the demands or requirements set forth in, I believe it's called the Cascadia Building Challenge, is that correct?
Yeah, the Living Building Challenge.
The Living Building Challenge. Yes. And that's a standard of performance that, as I understand, even exceeds LEED Platinum levels, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. It focuses on site, energy, materials, water, indoor quality, and beauty and inspiration. And it's a series of prerequisites as opposed to LEED being more tracking points as you're going through a process.
Uh-huh. And how did you become aware of the Cascadia Living Building Challenge?
Well, we were in a design charrette with our architects and also with John Todd from University of Vermont, and it was right at the very beginning of the birth of Living Building Challenge, and we had already committed to doing LEED, shooting for platinum on our building, and Living Building Challenge seemed more interesting to me, and it was something that intrigued me how it was a series of prerequisites in design as opposed to tracking process along the way. And I also liked the fact that it had a component to it that was documenting how the building actually performed over a period of time.
And that's been a we've talked about that on the program previously.
Uh-huh.
Our friend Henry Gifford has been a tireless campaigner, hounding the USGBC to release their data, which, of course, seems they're not going to do. So,
right.
What are some of the features of this building that are interesting, different, or particularly beautiful?
Well, first, maybe let me just say a little bit of how we wound up even, you know, thinking of this and coming to this place. The Omega campus was primarily constructed back in the 1950s with about 125 freestanding buildings, somewhat on the side of a hill with a lake at the bottom. And we produce about 35,000 gallons a day of wastewater, and we were reliant upon an antique septic system. So the question was, how are we going to responsibly deal with our wastewater? And we were working with John Todd as part of our Water of Life program that we came up with the Eco Machine system, and then we needed a building to put it in. And we wanted the building to essentially match some of the core values of Omega, such as what we do for sustainability.
Back up. What machine?
Eco Machine.
Eco Machine. What is that?
Eco Machine is a way of purifying wastewater with no chemicals through natural process. You essentially work with microorganisms, fish, plants, and you are purifying your wastewater, similar to what a stream would do or a wetland.
Okay, so in your case, you have feces eating lily pads or something. Is that right?
What we have is we have a series of constructed wetlands, and then we have what's called an aerated lagoon inside the building. The primary component in the building itself is a modified greenhouse that has the aerated lagoon section that's filled with tropical plants that actually the root systems act as habitat for microorganisms that actually continue the digestion process, plus the plants use the nutrients for their own growth.
Uh-huh.
And that part of the building is adjacent to our environmental classroom, which where we have local environmental organizations use it for their meeting space. We hold our sustainability program content there that we run every year as part of our course catalog. And so the building as a whole works as an education center. What we felt was that in the problem we were faced with our wastewater was an opportunity. And we wanted to take essentially the idea of wastewater and show that there really isn't any such thing as wastewater. And the opportunities that existed in wastewater as a way to continue to educate people about how we could potentially live differently.
Uh-huh.
And that's how we wound up in the building, okay, and committing to this process. And actually it dictated a lot of the program of the building because the building is fully accessible to people. The mechanical room has a glass wall. Everything is labeled. It connects to the campus as a whole. So when you use water on the campus, you can follow your usage. It's sort of the center of all the initiatives that we run on the campus.
I have a question. This is Gennaro. I know the Living Building Challenge requires, or part of it is to make food as part of the building property. Do you actually use the lot to make food?
No, we don't. And that's a secondary part to Living Building Challenge. That's sort of where there's so many versions of LEED. In the very beginning, that was not one of the criteria. All of our food stuff comes from local agriculture, sustainable agriculture. That's one of our primary initiatives. We don't actually grow anything in the Eco Machine, and you really wouldn't want to, given that what's growing there is actually still growing of what's really wastewater. But we do grow all of our ornamental flowers and everything for our classrooms there.
Okay, so the purification is not as total as a conventional Blackwater processing plant.
It's more so when it gets, by the time it gets through the end sand filtration. If we actually, you know, were to chlorinate it or put it through UV purification, it's clean enough to qualify as potable water, but you can't do that in New York State. So essentially we use it in irrigation, and we also, through a dispersal field, we basically are able to call it storm water, so we put it directly back into the aquifer.
Sure. That's interesting. What other? I guess what you're telling us is that the Eco Machine really was the driving concept that informed many of your other design responses for this building.
That's correct. It was really the seed that started the whole process, because we had a serious infrastructure issue, and I was sitting there saying I wanted to purify our water using as low an energy footprint as possible and no chemicals. And what we wound up with, and I also wanted an educational component, and what we wound up with was no chemicals, zero energy, and a classroom.
Interesting. Let's take a brief musical break, something calm and meditative, and come back and talk about some of the other systems in your building.
Great.
Burning Down the House, your weekly dose of architecture and design, in which, in this episode for December 16th, we're talking with Skip Backus at the Omega Institute. Also in studio are Jake Allspector and Gennaro Brooks Church. We're talking about the Omega Center for Sustainable Living, which is a... So we just have heard that many of the design decisions and intentions were driven by this interesting thing called the Eco Machine, a living processing. Well, what do we call it? It's a constructed wetland. Jake, during the break, you said you had something that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I was happy to hear you talk about beauty and inspiration, which I think is such an important part of sustainable design, because obviously, if something's not loved or valued by the community, not only for its, you know, low carbon footprint and all of that, but if it's ugly, you know, people are going to not want to maintain it, and it's going to be a failure, and you're going to want to replace it. So I was really happy to hear that, because so much of of sustainable design is critiqued because it's actually not necessarily anti-architectural, but a-architectural, you know, it sort of doesn't really deal with the design as a primary goal. And I thought that was very, very good. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about how your building might reflect that.
Sure. Well, first, Omega is an experiential learning center, so we wanted the building to have a sense that was everything would be accessible to people, and they would be able to feel and have a really clear experience when they went into the building. Everything from what does it smell like in the building to actually standing next to wastewater. You literally stand next to flowing wastewater in the building with plants 6 to 8 feet tall.
Holy shit, Batman.
Yeah, you don't have that smell. You don't have the nasty smell. And we take people through the experience of what happens when they flush their toilets and what it looks like 36 hours later, like it came out of your kitchen floor.
Do you allow toilet paper at the Omega Institute?
Yes, we are. Single ply.
Okay.
Single ply recycled content.
Now, is there like a cotton gin that shreds that as it's flowing through?
Or no, it actually, by the time you go across 200 acres of land from 120 buildings, the cycle of the water as it agitates through the piping coming down pretty much dissolves it all.
Uh-huh.
That's why we use the single ply.
Yes. So now what is that? Can you describe, even though you're getting off the track here, and what we've just described is not very aesthetic, but could you describe?
It's a different aesthetic.
Yeah, well, okay. Some people like it. But could you describe what happens between the source of the sewage and until it gets to your
yeah, what does the eco machine really look like?
Well, what does it look like before? I mean, you described that you can walk next to it and not get grossed out.
Right. So. Well, what happens is you have, again, everything from a large commercial kitchen that cooks over 2,000 meals a day. You have a cafe building. You have 120 buildings with toilets and showers in them, anywhere in occupancy around 700 people a day.
Mm.
And so all that wastewater heads first to solids collection, where we settle out the solids, and we have microorganism injections in there so that we can digest as fully as possible solids on the site without having to have them pumped off to a sludge facility or in Dutchess
County. I assume
that
produces methane.
Right. Or in Dutchess County, a lot of times they're literally sprayed on open land.
Right.
Do you capture the methane that's released?
No, because we don't have enough of a quantity to make it worthwhile.
Mm.
And being a nonprofit and dealing with fundraising even to get this project off the ground, I have a long list of things I'd like to play with. But
how much did this project cost?
This project was, in the end, $3.9 million.
So that's pretty cheap.
Well, relatively, but tell that to my board.
For how many square feet?
6,000 and 6,400 more or less by the time.
$500 a square foot more.
Ain't cheap.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, it is. It's a treatment plant.
That's the thing you have to remember.
You know.
It's actually a wastewater treatment plant. And if you were to build a conventional plant, you'd be somewhere in the same neighborhood. You're not going to be that much different. And the difference with this plant is we have zero energy footprint. So our overall operation cost of this is radically reduced.
Well, is that every month or over the entire cycle of a year?
Cycle of a year.
I see.
It's done through photovoltaics and net metering. And so basically we have a 48 kW solar array.
Uh-huh.
We generate more than we need in the summer and less than we need in the winter. But when you look at it at the end of the year, we're actually selling power back to our utility.
In excess. Or at least at par of what you're using.
Correct.
I'm supposing in the wintertime.
Correct.
Although you haven't been through a winter yet.
No, but we can already tell from, we have three significant arrays, and we monitor those every day. And there's really, even right now, we're exceeding what our usage is. So I don't have any doubt that we're going to be totally fine in our zero energy.
And your heating is with pipes
geothermal.
In the ground, is it in the ground loop? Oh, it's in the ground.
So you have a ground loop heat pump system.
Correct.
Yeah.
How come you didn't use the lake?
DEC.
Really?
Huh. Yeah. Yeah, and
because it would have been cheaper, right?
Sure. It would. A lot of things would have been cheaper, but by the time you had town restriction, DEC restriction, health department restriction, state of New York restriction, and anybody else that can add a restriction or a process into this.
So they wouldn't let the lake be a heat source and or heat dump. Yeah.
No. Part of the problem is partway through the process we discovered we had an endangered species on the property.
Which is?
Northern cricket frog.
It's a little tiny little thing?
Little tiny little frog. And so it became very limited what could happen on the site, around the site, adjacent to the site, and how we had to monitor the site during the construction process.
I see. So if you started laying pipes into the muck at the bottom of the lake, it might have made the cricket frogs unhappy and
yes.
croak.
Yep.
Oh, sorry. Now we're talking aesthetics here.
So you have a PV array.
Yes.
I'm guessing you have passive solar because I'm looking at a picture now.
Yes, we do.
And there's a whole lot of glass.
Yep.
I'm turning it around so my studio mate's going to have a look at this gorgeous picture. And there's timber in this building. I'm supposing that you obtained your timber from fairly nearby sources.
A surprising amount of our timber came salvaged. We worked with a company with a lot of salvaged materials, and we actually had some dismantled warehouse in Kingston, which is really only about, I think, 10, 15 miles from our site.
That's good. We like that. Our studio is 100% salvaged material.
Salvage material is definitely the way to go, especially if you're, you know, trying to conform to LBC or LEED. The quality of the material, especially now that salvage is no longer just a crew going in with sledgehammers, is actually, very workable. But you really have to spend time with your contracting team to go through a training process with them because it's not the same as pulling a skid of lumber off a truck.
So did you do your own salvage?
We did some of our own. Oddly enough, we had a building collapse the winter before from an ice storm. So we dismantled that and salvaged that as part of the building. I went and went to a couple of different warehouses in Philadelphia for our doors. For our restroom doors and classroom doors and that kind of thing.
Whoa, that's 150 miles.
Yeah, that is 150 miles.
Of course, it's within the 500-mile USGBC rule, which I think is, I think that's specious. I mean,
yeah. That's
a day of driving at highway speeds without a break.
Yep.
That's not really
local. The one I laugh at is the 8,000-mile radius for PV panels.
Yeah. And you know, when you start working in all of this and you're working with the mileage and you're working with the Living Building Challenge has a red list chemical restriction list.
Yeah.
And, no PVC.
And it gets really problematic in what you can actually use in the building and even finding out what's in materials because a lot of suppliers don't want to tell you.
True, and so true.
Where it comes from and what's in it.
Or they may simply just not know and not want to find out.
That's also true.
I mean, that's a real onerous thing. Now, something that Jake and I have talked about prior to this program is that buildings that are designed to be sustainable tend to have a sort of lack of luster.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have a very elegant greenhouse,
mm-hmm.
but it's not breaking any new architectural territory.
Right.
I mean, you don't even have any brise soleil on your south-facing glass. Mm-hmm. Is that double or triple glazed or anything like that?
It's double glazed. It's I can't tell you the particular gas that's inside. It's specific to greenhouse.
So it's two panes of glass in a sealed unit. It's not
correct.
It's not two layers of double glazed that we've seen in some, say, German buildings where they circulate the air flow in between there.
No.
Okay, but then you had budgetary limitations.
Yeah,
I don't wish to be negative.
Thank you.
Gennaro has something to say, I think.
No,
I was thinking.
I was going to point out that it's probably the prettiest.
Waste treatment plant
I've ever seen.
That's true.
But it's more than that.
Well, yeah, but it's really essentially that was the main push, right?
Yeah, it had to take care of that function, and it had to have the educational component that demonstrated all the different components that made up that process and the process of having a building that would fit our values of sustainability.
And you get that LEED point because of the educational thing.
Well, they don't care about LEED because they're the Living Building Challenge.
Which is a million times better.
And they've skipped over the whole USGBC thing, which is fine for me because I think they're like the Death Star, you know.
Well, it was interesting looking at for me, the main distinction between the two is one encourages honesty, whereas the other one, there's a lot of conflicts of interest. And the main thing is that all you have to do is say you're going to do it and you get the point.
Right.
Where it's living building challenge.
You have to prove it.
You have to prove it, but also there's a lot that's already given. It's like, you know, it's almost like, look, we're all grown-ups here. You're building something green. We're not even going to check this stuff. That's just given. And then they go from there. And then, again, you have to prove it like 12 months down the road. So it's definitely a million times better, living building challenge.
But it's not increments of unrelated aspects. And it really encourages, I think, thinking holistically or synthetically about a whole design of a building, because you can pick and choose, as one always does as a designer, pick and choose, you know, which materials, which forms, which systems, in order to create a more beautiful construct, I think.
Yeah, for sure. It's based around the lotus flower, right? The petals of the lotus flower.
Correct, yeah.
Now, in the OCSL, as you call it, what do you do for ventilation? How is that handled?
Well, we have, you know, your typical high and low window positions. And in the greenhouse area, we have four fans on the north side of the building that are temperature actuated and humidity actuated depending upon what's happening in the greenhouse. In the classroom space, there's the same type of cross ventilation, and then it's also air conditioned. Should we be running it in the summertime and get too hot in there or anything?
I have a question. Did you consider any existing buildings for this, or that wasn't a possibility?
No, because you can't really do this in a wood structure, which is why the language of the building became so much concrete, because of the amount of water that you're working with. And also we needed to have it in order, even though we were doing, and especially because we wanted to do a zero energy building, we needed to have the building downhill so that everything could run to it.
Sure.
So we didn't have all these pump systems all over the place and to get the wastewater to the building. So we had a site that really worked well in terms of getting the wastewater to it. And also we wanted this to be a year-round building. We have three or four buildings on our campus that are year-round. The rest are seasonal, and the main part of the program runs from April through November. The rest of the year we have about 75 year-round employees that are there. But we're using this building year-round. I just had the Red Hook and Rhinebeck sixth graders out for a tour of the building. We run tours by appointment in the off-season and every Wednesday and Saturday during the season, and they're constant. The tours, the amount of people that are coming through, just some amazing, amazing groups. And it's part of why we did this, so that people can come in and, you know, look at a geothermal system, look at a photovoltaic system, and also be in a building that meets the Living Building Challenge and realize that it's a very comfortable, hospitable place. It's fun to be there.
Can we take a train up to Rhinebeck?
Anytime you want.
Yeah, you can get up there, yeah.
Because I do, I teach also, and one of the things I do with some of my students, some of my courses, is I take them on field trips.
Yeah.
It sounds like an interesting thing to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, now that you've been in the building for 7 or 8 months,
right?
Are there aspects that you would do differently?
And some of it just has to do with we've already had some big snows up here, and the flat roof area that is the vegetated roof between the two other areas.
For those of you who are listening in live time, I have not yet posted any images on the companion blog, but what we have is two unequal in depth in the plan section.
Shed roofs.
With a flat roof in the middle.
Basically like a butterfly roof, but the valley in the middle is broader, and you're describing it as a... That's the green roof part, right?
Yes.
Correct.
And so that filled up with snow?
Yeah, and it also blocks the ventilation opportunities. Mm-hmm. With the full solar orientation, it gets hot in there so far in the winter.
Yeah.
And there's no way, unless I put somebody up on that roof to start shoveling and totally destroy my roof up there, that I'm going to open up those upper windows.
And of course, you have really good insulation in the roof, so the snow's not going to melt anytime soon.
It's not exactly. Going anywhere. It's there for the whole winter.
Well, I was curious about that. For the greenhouse, the plant part, so to speak, the mm-hmm. processing part, mm-hmm. you don't really need to insulate or heat it, right? There's people walk through it, but... Do people hang out in it?
Absolutely.
I thought the classroom was separate. Oh, I thought the classroom was...
No, there's a classroom area that's adjacent to the ponds, and then there's a separate area.
But it's all one space.
No, it's two separate spaces. But
It's like a loft building, and there's a partition, across the fifth point.
Correct. And we use both sides for classroom space, and... we've had in the lagoon side, I've had, 150 people in there explaining to them how the process works, them trying to find the fish that are swimming in there and identifying the different plants and the microorganisms under the microscope. And then we run other kinds of programs in the classroom next door, a film series, panel discussion, actual course content. So both sides are really classroom-oriented. And I could have saved a lot of money on the project had I not wanted to build in so much extra space in the greenhouse. You can literally walk around all the lagoons, and you have room for, an entire class of, 50, very active children moving around and, looking at what's going on.
All right, and certainly plenty of places for people to put out their yoga mats.
Oh, yeah.
And...
It's actually one of the preferred classrooms on campus because the air is almost as if you were at the beach in the terms of the way that it feels.
Really? Well, that's probably your ceiling fans at work.
Yeah. Well, it's also, I think, a lot to do with the amount of plants that are in the building.
Yeah. So there's a higher O2 component in the mm-hmm. in the average air.
There does seem to be. I'm looking at a print I made of the architect's off the architect's website, having done my due diligence research before this, but there seems to be light shelves in there, right? Both at the sill and sort of
light shelves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for reflecting back.
Well, you were commenting on the Curtis. You were commenting on the lack of brisolet.
Yeah.
So there is a sort of
that. Yeah, I was wondering at that. You know.
Brisolet is a architectural French term, coined by Le Corbusier, I think, and
sunbreaker.
Yeah, sunbreaker.
Yeah, but there's only the midpoint one was not installed. So
oh, it wasn't. I see.
That rendering
value engineering
on this site is not as built.
I see. Okay.
So you were talking about how you would do it differently.
Yeah, I don't think I would have that center flat roof section in between two shed roofs like that with the window sections through there the way that they are. I think eventually it could be a good-sized problem for us as you have snow over those structures for extended periods of time over a number of years.
Could you divert? I probably can't do it now, but you could have diverted some of the heat or the water that's heated there to melt the snow.
Which may be one of the things we go back in and look at.
Yeah. When there's snow, you crank up those fans and heat the snow and saturate your green roof.
Yep.
And then you have a problem of water runoff from the melted snow.
Well, that
just
we
add it to the pond.
Yeah, that gets drained off into, we have a whole stormwater section of the building that can deal with that, no problem.
Yeah, that's one of the aspects of the building that I found was really rather refreshing. You supply your your fresh drinking water with cisterns and and collecting rainwater.
Yeah.
An old-fashioned good idea.
Yeah, yeah, it works great. We have a filtration program that it goes through and a UV light, and it works wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that you could do in your houses and that you're working on in Brooklyn.
Yeah, yeah, I was just thinking about that.
You know, it's an old-fashioned thing, and there were periods of time in New York City in the early 1800s when fresh water was hard to come by, and there was cholera, and there were water trucks that went through the streets, but people who were smart had cisterns, mm-hmm. and they collected the rainwater and only occasionally had to buy fresh water from one of the water trucks.
Yeah, I should look into that.
Yeah, so aside from the snow buildup, mm-hmm. Anything else that we've learned over the last few months of the living building?
Most of it would relate to the eco machine. The building itself seems to be working, you know, wonderfully and as we thought. I think most of our challenges come into learning how to be in relationship to a natural process and how to work with microorganisms and plants and snails and realizing that they need to be fed.
Snails? You have snails?
Lots of snails.
Are you going to harvest them at some point?
We could. We could. There's, you know, you can actually, you know, grow fish in this if you want.
It's not so far from you up to the CIA in New Hyde
that's
Park.
That's right. You know, one other interesting thing about the lagoon area is, you know, when we were doing the energy models for the building, typically you would do this in a full greenhouse, and you'll notice from the models that you're looking at, we really only have the southern glass, but we have what are called solar trackers in the roof area, which allowed us to fully insulate the majority of the roof. And the solar trackers, there are 8 of them up there, and what they are, they have a 3-section mirror in them that through a little PV cell follows the path of the sun during the day and reflects the light down onto the plants.
Now, wait, this is new news.
Yeah,
now, how does this work? I got the track the sun, but where are the reflectors located?
In the actual dome of the skylight. These are about, I think they're about 4 foot by 4 foot, maybe a little under, and there's 8 of them in the building. And instead of having all glass on the roof, that you would have all the energy impact of that,
yes.
We have these, and they have a little tiny electric motor that has a photocell on it, a little tiny PV array, rather. And over the course of the day, there's 3 mirrors in there that follow the sun by the rotation of the motor and the photovoltaic cell and reflect the sunlight or any light down onto the plants.
Wow.
So in other words, you're focusing the light and the sun from those in their reduced footprint on the roof, having the same impact because of the mirrors and the diffusers to bring that amount of light necessary for the plant photosynthesis.
I like that.
But aren't the plants in a southern-facing greenhouse?
Yes,
they are. But
it's only south. So as the sun goes west,
yep.
The light monitors are following the west light, which can be really, in the Hudson River Valley, can be really intense.
Yeah.
And are bouncing the light down into the growing fields. I like that technology.
Yeah, it works great.
Now, is this unique to your building?
It's relatively new. I don't know if anywhere else it's used. I'm sure it's a company that was a startup company. And
what company is that?
We were... It's solartracker.com. You find them that way.
Okay.
And,
that's good news.
Yeah, and there are some challenges with the product, but I think as they, you know, go through their work, as any new product, they'll get ironed out. But I'm very happy with the concept of how they deliver for us.
I'm very excited by this.
Yeah.
This is,
the main thing with it is it's not sealed dome, so you essentially lose a lot of heat through the dome. And in our situation, because we have high humidity, the dome condenses. So we're still working on that issue.
Uh-huh.
It's the only area in the entire greenhouse that we have any condensation issues.
Well, why did you decide not to do a double insulated
dome?
They
didn't come with them.
You mean that the product actually comes with the dome?
Well, you can put another box of insulated glass around it and
that's of the things you learn as you're going,
sure.
You're going along.
Yeah.
It's amazing in terms of, what it saved us in our energy footprint, being able to fully insulate the roof.
Yeah, and also your secondary enclosure, which necessarily will have to be below your roof plane, could have Freinet lensed glass to spread the light everywhere,
mm-hmm.
which
mm-hmm.
could be a really nice thing.
What do you do? Can you control that in the summer so you can reject the sunlight if it's too intense?
With the solar trackers?
Yes.
Yes, manually. It's not an automatic. You have to go up. I would most likely just take the, all you have to do is go up with a hook and you take off the mirror assembly.
I see.
Uh-huh. And the most likely that will come down probably in June.
Right. Or you could shroud the skylight.
One or the other, shade the skylight out. But you're picking up.
Or as we used to do in the old days with greenhouses, just whitewash it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. Well, you can stay on. We're going to take another little break. And you can stay on as long as you can stand it. And I want to have a little conversation with my friends here about sustainable design and what it looks like. This is Burning Down the House, your weekly fix for Architecture and Design. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. Here with me in the studio are Gennaro Brooks Church, Eco Builder. You don't like that?
No, it's great.
Okay. And Jake Allspector, architect and professor. And we still have, I think, Skip, are you still there?
I'm still here. Skip
Backus from the Omega Institute. A very, if I may use a 60s term, groovy place in Rhinebeck, New York. And we've been talking about your new building. Now we're going to trash talk a little bit. And it's no offense to you, mm-hmm. but sustainable buildings tend to, your building is a prime example of, well, it disproves our bias, which is that sustainable buildings tend to look like orthopedic appliances. Because when you start getting into the technique and the technical aspects that must be considered, you've got a machine that's not necessarily elegant or eloquent. Or Jake, jump in here. Come on.
Help me out. I mean, I think it's again back to the beauty thing, which we actually sort of quickly verged into technology when I asked the beauty question.
Right.
So, the real challenge is to have these buildings as beloved as great works of architecture, and I don't think there's any kind of contradiction in that.
It
doesn't need to be at all. I just think people need to hire good architects, and architects need to learn about this part of reality and integrate it into their thinking, just as they've done everything else.
I think that sustainable building can also look like the other extreme. I mean, it could look like a hippie's armpit.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like God.
But it can look like just somebody who, smoked a lot of pot and did it themselves kind of thing. And for me, sustainable design is very similar to vegetarian cooking. And if you remember at the beginning, vegetarian cooking tasted like crap.
Right.
And it didn't have its
paradox in the East Village.
Yeah, it was either didn't taste.
Fifth Street. Yeah. Sixth.
It's true, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Until it found its own identity.
It was horrible to eat. It had no flavor.
And it just didn't work. And then what happened is it found its own identity, which was not trying to be like beef or trying to be something it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Or the other side of it, which was a complete rejection of the taste of beef. And I think we're finding that process now in sustainable architecture, which is still in its infancy.
It can have some flavor.
It will come into its own. It is coming into its own.
This,
for example, Roberta's restaurant is a good example. It's finding its own style, not dependent on the judgment of other
architects. Although the feng shui lady that we had in July said that Roberta's is a horror because all of the exposed roof joists are knife edges, and it puts people on edge. And makes them angry.
And makes them drink more.
And unhappy.
And you get more money.
Well, maybe that makes them drink more. do you have exposed beams in the OCSL?
Only the steel section.
Only in the steel section.
You can see the steel sections as they're coming through.
So you had said why you had made it out of steel rather than, say, wood or timber.
Well, there is timber.
Yeah, there is some timber in the area that houses the mechanical room and the bathroom spaces and the.
But why was it necessary to make it out of steel?
Well,
I'm just curious.
Primarily, the language was dictated by a lot of the requirements of the Eco Machine because you have to remember you're dealing all the time with significant amounts of water moving through the building. You're moving literally 30,000 to 40,000 gallons of water through that building every day.
Right. Well, that's the water is not held by steel. It's held by concrete,
No, but
right?
You don't want to have, with concrete as far as the walls and the floor and so
sure.
forth, it has to be very serviceable and resistant to rot.
Sure, but what would prevent you from using, you know, reclaimed barn beams, heavy timbers,
or
constructed
trusses, laminated bent beam,
right, made out of recycled lumber, right?
Yeah. Well, the laminated beams, we have a couple in there. We had such a hard time finding them that didn't have formaldehyde as an adhesive.
Oh, that's true.
And the act would have FSC wood and no formaldehyde.
Well, you could use trusses.
No urea formaldehyde.
Formaldehyde. You can have phenol formaldehyde.
Yeah. You know what would have been cool is to get the wood from the Hudson River.
The docks?
No, the sunken wood.
The sunken wood, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
that would have been really rock.
The ancient wood.
Yeah, it's right. Nice stuff.
Would have been hard as steel.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think one
for
of the things,
your next building.
Yeah, my next one. One of the things to also remember, because I certainly appreciate the conversation around the aesthetic beauty and architecture and so forth, that we had a very limited budget, being a nonprofit.
That's a cop out.
it was tough. It was tough to out to the Living Building Challenge and incorporate a wastewater.
That may be. But aesthetically, I've seen some wonderful work, and in fact, you know, I even my favorite projects are the ones that have the most severe budget constraints, because it really pushes you, you know, to be inventive and to deal with a reduced set. You know, it's much harder to do a good building when someone gives you a blank check. Well, you know, you don't know what to do. It's unlimited.
I wonder at the ceiling fans. I mean, I don't want to be Luddite about this, but I'm just wondering whether there's a way to have convective air circulation, perhaps some sort of curved planar cold surfaces near the ceiling that cause condensation, and something you might add. It'd be a good design problem for your students, Professor.
Cause convection, you mean?
Yes.
That kind of stuff. Yeah, there's a lot of work being done on that. And a lot of the work in Europe, particularly on sustainable architecture, really does use all kinds of engineered wood and for huge spans and all kinds. I'm sure you know this.
Yeah.
I'm sure your architects know that. You know, it's interesting because I think the challenge with any kind of design is optimization, and I think that Living Building Challenge allows you to optimize things, I guess, as opposed.
I think it encourages you to optimize things, yeah.
As opposed to lead, which just kind of says if you throw in a bike rack here and a thing here and all that, and maybe totally disparate the ugliest, most stupidest assemblage of things that
get
won't...
get 12 photographs of the bike rack.
That's right.
Wouldn't it be great if there was a system that had a jury of 10 or 12 people from the community to decide whether your building was beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that be an interesting thing?
We actually had charrettes with people from the town. We had a lot of community involvement in this project, because that's one of our primary roles in the town of Rhinebeck, because in a lot of ways we're one of the big fish in town, so we like to make sure that what we do is fully understood and appreciated and people feel a part of. So there was a lot of conversation, a lot of input, and during the early...
Well, so were any of the community comments such that you changed dramatically any aspect? Or was it just all of a process?
There were some good things that came in. The site changed a little bit. The way that the building is lit on the outside changed a little. Nothing that, you know, earth-shattering, where you would say, hey, this person came in and changed the projects, you know, significantly. But enough that it was a valuable process, and certainly one that at the end of the day, when the building was done and everybody came back, they felt as if they already knew the building and were part of it. And
well, how is it lit on the outside? I'm sorry, I'm very detail-oriented.
It just has several downlights mounted on the exterior of the building at the different entrances.
And they're powered from your PV array.
They're powered from the PV, yeah.
Cool.
So all the sewage from the Omega Institute is now being diverted into this one place.
That's correct, 100%.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
That is really awesome.
Yeah.
And then what do you do with the water after it's been done with in the wintertime?
In the wintertime, it basically goes back into the aquifer. It's qualified as stormwater.
Well, how do you get it into the aquifer? You can't disperse it over the ground in the winter.
No, we do what are called dispersal fields, which are different than your septic-type fields. It's essentially a way of disposing of stormwater subsurface. You use what are called infiltrators, and they are like arches that get built in the ground that hold a suspended pipe that just give you a way of injecting the water back into the ground.
Oh, so they're discharge wells.
They're discharge wells, essentially. Horizontal discharge wells.
Right.
With sand.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Well, fellas, we've come to the end of another really interesting conversation. I think there might be more that we would want to talk with you about, but tonight we've kind of run out of time.
Yeah, anytime you want, and you're welcome to come up and visit.
I hope that at the Omega Institute that you're considering serving Hearst Ranch beef. Because they're happy cattle ranging over a ranch that's 10 times larger than the island of Manhattan.
Wow.
Dig on that. I mean, that's amazing.
Do they eat stuff that doesn't make them fart?
No, well, they eat grass. They're not eating corn, so I think they fart less. So their methane contribution to the ozone is far less. But they're good friends of the station, and they're good friends of this program. Thank you, Jake.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Gennaro.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Thank you, Jack Inslee, producer. Thank you, Nat Wiener, my engineer par excellence. And next week, hold on. Keep it down. The next program live on HeritageRadioNetwork.com will be A Taste of the Past at 12 p.m., tomorrow, Thursday, December 17th, hosted by food historian Linda Palacio, mother of Jake Palacio, our already host of, what is it?
Zach Palacio, host of Urban Foragers.
Thank you. Join us next year in 2010. When we'll resume live broadcasts of Burning Down the House. Now, you can dig on the Talking Heads. Ramp it up.